It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2022, returning MOI Global instructor, Matthew Peterson, the managing partner of Peterson Capital Management, which he founded in 2011. PCM manages a long-term, concentrated, value-based fund with a 10-year annual track record of nearly 19%. Matt has been a financial professional for two decades, is a CFA charter holder, and has worked with Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, American Express, and Ameriprise Financial. And Matt, it's such a great pleasure to have you back with us. I've enjoyed your presentations in the past, and I really appreciate also the differentiated structured value approach that you have that I think you're going to touch on later in the presentation. So without further ado, Matt, I'd love to turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here with you and MOI. It's a pleasure to be back. It's a pleasure to be part of the whole community. And this year, I'll be discussing a fairly controversial holding. In fact, I think many will reject the idea because at a glance, the optics look pretty terrible. But we've done significant work on this position, including a property by property analysis and valuation of 170 assets that are part of their portfolio. But I want to be clear, the objective here is not to convince your viewers that they need to have this in their portfolio. Instead, I'm just providing some thoughts on our own research and some shortcuts for those who want to take another look at this opportunity. Part of the challenge with Seritage is that the story has been very confusing, but that also happens to be part of the reason that the opportunity here is so great. So my hope is to provide some clarity as I expect us to make a significant return with this holding. So to begin, I'll start off with a quick management and business overview, followed by the property by property analysis and our NAV calculations. Then I'll discuss some financing and the cash flows. And as you alluded to, for those who do stick around, I will conclude with by touching on a structured value case study that we're applying today. The opportunity here is really offering incredible gains, and I know the approach is pretty unique, and many in the community have found it intriguing and profitable. And so I'm happy to be in a position to share another case study. So to kick things off, let's just talk quickly about what is Seritage. Seritage is a North American real estate investment trust. It was formed through the sale leaseback strategy that was executed by Sears prior to their bankruptcy. So there's 50 plus, I think 56 employees at Seritage, and they are focused on repurposing and unlocking the value in 170 diversified retail properties. So this REIT is unique in many ways. It uniquely pays no dividend because their cash flows are all being reinvested in the redevelopment pipeline. And there's a high quality management team. And as you'll see, it's undervalued from a Graham and Fisher perspective. But importantly, at under 700 million, it's actually closer to 650 million. This is a fully diluted. This is a small cap compounder with years of capital reinvestment opportunities at really attractive rates of returns ahead. But you know, what's sort of surprising today is how terrible the economics look on the surface. There's really so much fear that it's become highly controversial. There is a C-suite that has completely turned over, CEO, CFO, COO, all flipped. It's a REIT, as I mentioned, with no dividend. There's a confusing corporate structure because Eddie Lampert has all these units that are now being converted into shares. There is a you know, shift to e-commerce, and this is also mall ownership during a pandemic. There was the Sears bankruptcy. Until very recently, all of the debt, 100% of the debt was maturing in July 2023. There's negative cash flow. There's a fairly confusing property set and even strategy. And there's been a real lack of transparency. So, you know, this, again, it's highly controversial. But very importantly, there's an opportunity with the new leadership that's steering the ship. So there was previously a great team led by Ben Schall and Brian Dickman, and they've departed. And people reacted with alarm. Investors reacted with alarm. But it was actually for good reasons. I think, you know, part of it is that they went through quite a bit of hardship. They weathered some enormous exogenous events, from a Sears bankruptcy to the collapse in the commercial real estate market to the pandemic. And Ben Schall, for example, was offered a CEO position at AvalonBay. So he pivoted from basically a 500 million cap company to a 25 billion market cap company. And I don't, you can't really fault him or Seritage for making that sort of a career move. The new CEO, Andrea Olshan, has an excellent academic pedigree, undergrad at Harvard and an MBA from Columbia. And she grew up in a New York real estate family, and in her 30s, took over as CEO of Olshan Properties, her family business. And they were operating 29 million square feet of mixed use property in 11 states. So she was very successful, and this is a great match for her. We're very excited to have her running the show. And she's actually commented on the supportiveness of Buffett and Munger and Ajit Jain. And it's nice to know there's at least some conversations happening and maybe guiding some decisions from those folks. The big unknown today is that there's a new CFO, John Garrilli. He has been involved in a few, in several real estate liquidations in the past, and they've created shareholder value. But we are actually encouraged by his involvement because, as I'll show you, they have a real estate recycling program underway. They're looking to exit about 10 million square feet of property. And that property doesn't really fit the profile of the strategic profile of the future portfolio. So they're liquidating these properties so that they can reinvest into higher IRR projects. So, you know, like management, the mission is also very shareholder friendly. The mission is to maximize value for shareholders by repositioning the company's portfolio through leasing, redevelopment, formation of the strategic partnerships, and other bespoke solutions. And as Andrea has pointed out, sharing here, this is really a value creation story. They're looking to demystify this company. And most importantly, they are all NAV all day long. So Andrea has aggressively reorganized the firm and the portfolio to try to provide this transparency. She's doing quite well with it. And given the unique cash flow situation for the REIT, where it's all being reinvested, and the impacts of sort of this all NAV all day long strategy, I think people would be really pleased to go and review the Q3 supplemental detail where they really clarify their strategy. And they point out this new end use, and they classify every property around the future use of the property. And it's laid out right here. As I've mentioned, we have analyzed every one of these 170 properties. We valued each one independently, and they have organized the 170 into five portfolio sets with multi-tenant retail, premier mixed-use property, there's residential, and then there's the retail with their JV partners. And so, you know, if you want to figure out the value, as Buffett says, you start with the A's, because you have to figure out what they're all worth. And so with the help of a couple of interns, we've done all that work. In fact, it's enormous amount of work. We visited each one on Google Maps, Street View. We visited many of them physically in person. And at the bottom, you'll see our highly conservative estimate for each value, for the value of each category. So at the bottom here, you see we have $600 million in multi-tenant retail. We have $300 million in premier mixed-use property. We have $600 million in residential and $310 million with their retail, with their JV partners. And I will also add here at the bottom that they have something called densification. The densification capability with these properties is very misunderstood. In many locations, if you think about Sears, it's a one-story big box legacy Sears warehouse. And it's incredibly overparked with an average of 13 acres in space per property. So they're using all of this space to add out parcels in the parking lots. They're building multiple stories in some cases. In a number of locations, they're building multi-story, multi-family units for rent. They're converting parking lots into new multi-story leasable square feet. So our estimates here ignore a lot of the densification capability, and that's going to add another layer of enormous value. So finally here, I'm sure you noticed there's only four categories. They do have a fifth category, other. These properties are those that are being aggressively liquidated. They are providing capital that's reinvested into the four strategic categories for the future. So, we hope that the new CFO, John Garelli, takes an active role in strategically monetizing these assets. And I think that will be a key responsibility for him. They're not all Class A properties. Some are vacant legacy Sears box stores, but there's others like San Bruno that recently sold for $55 million and they're worth a lot. So they have 10,000 square feet. They actually have more than 10,000, almost 11,000 square feet within these 70 other properties. And if they get an average sale price of $100 a square foot, they'll raise $1 billion in cash. And this is their capital recycling program. So they're not liquidating to simply keep the lights on. They have a long-term view of the strategic property set, and they are strategically allocating capital to the highest IRR opportunities available. So quickly, I will provide our analysis on a couple of properties so you can see what's actually happening and recognize the real value. So Esplanade in Aventura, Florida. This is a premier mixed-use property. This was a legacy Sears box with an out parcel, and now they've converted it into 215,000 square feet of mixed-use retail space that opened last year and is now 50% leased. So you can see here the range of base rent that they're receiving. These are reported rates. They're getting $56 a square foot at the low end, $125 at the high end, and the medium rate is $100. So in the gray box, if we assume a conservative average of $90 per square foot, and expect 70 of that as net operating income. Again, this is very conservative. We can look up the values with the CBRE cap rate survey and see the actual cap rates for a Fort Lauderdale suburb. And it's the cap rate is, you know, the average is 5.5%. So they actually refer to this in the documentation as Miami. The address is technically Miami, but it's also very close to Fort Lauderdale. And we really are conservative with these numbers. Fort Lauderdale's suburban property is not quite as valuable as Miami. So those are the cap rates we want to be using. And you just run the math. When this is fully leased out, that makes this stabilized property worth $270 million. So that's the first property. Let's take a look at another property in progress. This is Heritage Village, which is in Hicksville, New York. It's currently being repurposed into 250,000 square feet of commercial and retail property. They have some tenants that are already leasing out some space. And so to calculate this value, we had to assess the land value, which is already owned at $100 per square foot. And we know it's 200 per square foot to build on that land. So it's 300 per square foot in total, including the land that they already own. So there's a 200 bips spread here. So they build to a 7 cap and with stabilized NOI, they can assess it at a 5% cap rate. So then you can just look through the math. So the development costs here are $75 million. It's 200 a square foot times the 250,000 square feet plus the $100 a square foot for the land that they already own. The NOI then becomes 5.25 million, and they're building that to a 7 cap. So with their stabilized NOI, the value here should be 105 million. And that's projected then at a 5 cap. So this is 30 million in value creation from 75 million to the 105 million. And this will be developed over 36 months. And so we want to discount that back just at 15%. So that gives us 20 million in value today. And further, the advantage, of course, that Seritage has with these projects is that they already own the land. So the land is worth 25 million. So the total value here is $45 million. And it's half built with a lot of potential. And 45 million is truly about what they would get for it today. This property is quite a large property in New York. And if we go back a few slides, I'm going to illustrate how conservative we're being. You can see here, Hicksville. So Hicksville was valued at 45 million and the Esplanade is 270 million. So that gives us 350 million value from those two properties, just those two properties today, both in the premier mixed use property category, but there's actually seven properties, including the two JVs in this premier mixed use category. And we have the whole category valued at 300 million. So, you know, we have big margin of safeties here. We can be quite wrong with these numbers and still have conservatively estimated this bucket. This, I think, vastly underestimates the true value today. There's an enormous value margin of safety, and there's other value creation underway. So not only are we undervaluing it today, but it's going to be substantially increasing over the next few years. I don't mean to jump back in slides here, but in terms of the multi-tenant retail, it's actually worth noting that there are 6 million square feet in the properties. And that means we're valuing this bucket at just $100 per square foot. This is like a strategic property portfolio for them. Many of these are worth 200 or more per square foot. So when you get through valuing each of the 170 properties, I'm certain you'll agree that they're worth significantly more than what we've listed here. But honestly, very few people have done the work. There's a large short interest in Seritage, and the most of the bears case are complaining about the negative cash flow or the fact that they're liquidating properties. Uh, but they're not realizing the true value of this property portfolio. So again, since the story is all NAV all day, let's look at the valuation from a balance sheet perspective. So this is a simple sum of the parts from what we've covered. So we have multi-tenant retail with 600 million conservative, premier mixed use, very conservative, 300 million, residential, 600 million, the retail with their JV partners, 310 million. And we have this other category they're liquidating for $1 billion. So the total equity value of the properties is 2.8 billion. And they have about 160 million in cash. And with these kind of round numbers, we can look at this about $3 billion in total assets, all right? So they have one main component of debt, this Berkshire Hathaway loan. It's at a 7% rate, which is very high. They have $1.44 billion outstanding. And again, this matures in July of 2023. And then they have a small amount of preferred shares outstanding, and those have a 7% rate as well. So, with $1.5 billion in value, if obviously the $3 billion and take away the $1.5 billion, it leaves you with $1.5 billion value. So with $1.5 billion in value and 56 million shares, which are fully diluted, they account for all the units that are owned by Eddie Lampert, that are being converted, we see really conservatively that there's $26 in net asset value per share today with these really conservative estimates. And that actually gives you well over 100% upside from today's price, which is about 12. And further, I think it's worth acknowledging that their loan to value is only 50%. And as you know, most real estate deals are more highly levered with much lower rates, which we'll also get into. The other way to sort of analyze the value would be from an operating earnings perspective. And so here are the list of their top tenants. And you can see they're often these large value-based retailers like Dick's and Nordstrom Rack and Ross. And these retailers and their businesses did well during the pandemic, the value-based retailers. And they're also willing to sign long-term leases. And they're further interested in expanding as new strategic locations are developed. So I think in the future with further stabilized NOI, this is going to become much more clear. But we have a few data points that are, I think, worth pointing out today. So we've sort of looked at this across three buckets. Each one happens to round to about $1 billion in value. So first we have properties that have been developed with paying tenants. These are often the triple net leases. They have 93 million in revenue coming from this category. And so we expect conservatively NOI of 74 million coming out of this. And if we use a really conservative 7% cap rate versus the industry standard, which is closer to 5% today, these properties are worth 1.1 billion. This math is really simple when you start to look at it on a property by property level. Next, the signed but not operating leases. These are the projects that are being developed right now that have signed tenants waiting to move in upon completion. They have 36 million from those contracts. So we reasonably expect another 80% of that, 29 million in NOI annually over the next 12 months or so, which gives us this value of 414 that you can see here in the green. Next, we have a lot of square foot, still in the second book, we have a lot of square footage that's being developed without a signed tenant today. So those will be filled, and we expect we'll conservatively provide another 45 million in NOI. And using the same 7% cap rate, which again is conservative, we get a combined value here of $1 billion. And then finally, as mentioned previously, we have the non-core, which are these other assets that we have valued at about $1 billion. So down at the bottom, if you combine that all with their cash, the debt, we've included thinking about this over maybe a three-year time horizon that there's going to be some expected CapEx, including development costs. And we're including a very low value for some multifamily apartments. They have $1.5 billion in value by 2025. And we're really not giving much value to this extensive amount of land that they own. So if they have, even if it takes till 2025 to realize this value of $1.5 billion, the conservative figures provide us with a path to $26 a share, which would be a 19% annual IRR. So the shares today are priced, they're priced under 13, John, when I sent you the slides, they're actually priced about 12. That implies a 19% annualized return on this business in, you know, a zero interest rate environment with these extraordinarily conservative rent assumptions. And so I think there can be many positive surprises to the upside. So with that, let's address the debt quickly, because I think it's very misunderstood. First, all of Berkshire Hathaway, so Berkshire Hathaway has been a great partner throughout this process. They provided $1.6 billion in debt with a $400 million extension if certain covenants were met. And the general, all of the debt has very light covenants. And as I mentioned previously, Andrea has commented on how helpful Warren and Charlie and Ajit Jain have been. However, everyone is aware that this debt is very expensive. They pay Berkshire 7% plus an additional 1% on the $400 million they have potential access to, while a stabilized developed property could refinance for, you know, sub 4% today. So the objective, they've made it clear that the objective is to obtain property level financing across the board. They will immediately save about 300 basis points or $40 million annually. And in this process, Berkshire has agreed to extend $800 million of the existing line of credit through 2025, which is going to help them on this journey to achieve this property level financing. So the extension that they've been offering, that they have been offered, I think it alarmed the market because they didn't recognize that there's this desire to be at property level financing. And it looks like a reduction in the total credit line, but that's not the intention. This extension is removing the risk of a liquidity issue because next July, the other loan was set to mature. So finally, before going into the structured value component, I'm going to provide you with the JV partners that Seritage is regularly working with, because they also provide an advantage that I think is really misunderstood and certainly not well understood. So Seritage is working with these JV partners and building these deals where they are committing the property at marked up valuations, and then the JV partner is committing the capital for the redevelopment. So this is a unique way of doing these deals. It provides a meaningful source of capital for large scale multi-year projects, and it allows there to be higher value creation with faster timelines. So because the cash equity that's necessary from Seritage is then greatly reduced and the property gets an immediate bump up in value, the percent of the value created is much higher for Seritage when they do these JV deals. And again, most importantly, they don't have to put up the money to get the development underway. So for anyone who wants to learn more about that, there is a really clear example in their recent REIT World presentation, which is on their website. I've also included an example in the appendix here if you're able to get a hold of this presentation. I hope everyone understands that from a NAV and cash flow perspective, we see a very conservative value in the high 20s today. And as they repurpose and redevelop and then densify each of these portfolio assets, they can then be worth significantly more. But of course, as John mentioned at the beginning, that's not all. So we now come to the exciting part of the presentation, the application of our structured value practices. We've discussed this in past MOI presentations, and there's some other presentations, podcasts, and material on our YouTube channel where we talk about this as well. We do not purchase shares like a retail investor through the New York Stock Exchange. Instead, we use the Chicago Board of Exchange to write a cash secured put as a tool for our equity ownership. So we basically guarantee that we're going to buy somebody else's shares for a specific price should the shares decline, and they pay us for that commitment. And just to be clear here, I sold one of these contracts last week. So this is a very real case study. And if you like what I've shared here on Seritage, you can use the market volatility to your advantage, just like we do. So, today we are selling put contracts that expire in January, 2023 with a strike price of 12 and being paid $2.40 and even more for those contracts. As you look through this, what are the possible outcomes? First, you'll note that these prices change very quickly. Shares a couple of days ago were at $12.70. And if the shares decline below our $12 strike price that we're specifying, our counterpart will put the shares to us for a net cost of $12 minus the $2.40 they paid us for the contract, for a net cost to us of $9.60. So we will purchase the shares in January 2023 for the net cost of $9.60 while they're selling in the market today for $12.70. So that's a 25% discount to the cost in the New York Stock Exchange today. So, when the shares double, when their thesis is realized, we now earn 150% because our denominator is lower. And further, when the shares reach the conservative expected 26% stock price, we then earn 28% annualized if that takes 4 years. Compound over 4 years through 2025, instead of the previously large compound rate of return of 16% annualized from today through 2025, if you were to just buy the stock. All right. So what would happen if the shares do not decline below 12? Then we simply keep the premium that's paid for to us. So we will earn the $2.40 on our $9.60 in collateral over 12 months, which gives us an astonishing 25% return in a year without even owning the shares. So finally, because many ask about risk, there's a large embedded margin of safety that is notable. First, because the firm is backed with these hard real estate assets that are worth more than the market price today. And second, through our purchase method. So if we're wrong about the valuation, and frankly, we aren't wrong about this valuation. We're only paying $9.60 net for the same stock that costs $12.70 to a retail investor. So the shares can actually decline 25% and we're still going to make money. So, you know, the decline feels very unlikely, but should it happen, our portfolio is just fine. So, you know, you don't need to follow all the math, but I think what you can recognize here is that the structured value strategy involves using puts as a tool to purchase the stock for below market prices. And finally, before taking questions, John, it's, I think, worth acknowledging that this firm is owned by a few wonderful and famous value investors. You know, these four gentlemen, Warren Buffett, Guy Spier, Eddie Lampert, and Manish Pabrai own about 18% of all of the shares fully diluted outstanding. And there are many others. So we're monitoring the developments at Seritage very closely. We continue to sell puts during volatile moments and accumulate various shares. And today our very modestly sized fund with about 20 million AUM now owns over 0.5% of all of Seritage. And with that, John, I will turn it back over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Matt, for the wonderful presentation. Maybe just to follow up on that last slide, Monish Pabrai, I believe, sold some shares recently. Do you have any color on that at all?
I don't have any specific insight as to why. I did see that as well. This is the reduced share count. I did see that he was buying a new position in Turkey. And so it's potential. And this was also a fairly large position for Manish. So it could just be a simple opportunity cost of capital. I don't have any particular insight, but, you know, at one point before the shares were diluted, he had owned, I think, 12% of shares outstanding. This was a large position for Manish. I don't think it's surprising to see him trim or you know, move the percent holding around. I hope to get some more color over time.
Got it. And maybe you have some thoughts on Eddie Lampert. I'm just curious whether his stake has basically stayed pretty constant over time. I assume he got the shares through Sears. Has he added or sold to your knowledge?
I have some thoughts. I've never spoken with Eddie about his position, but I think Lampert. So the units were in ESL, his fund, and I'm wondering, and he recently filed to have them converted to shares, and that sort of spooked the market. There's a lot of things that seem to be spooking the market, but it's sort of like first level thinking that's spooking the market, and then second level thinking allows you to understand what's going on. So I think it's very possible that Lampert could be working toward liquidating his fund. I also think that the units were not transferable. So I think he might possibly have had to transfer them to shares to keep them. And we haven't seen him sell any shares. That was what the market was originally concerned about when the filings went out that he was converting his shares, was that he'd be converting and selling. But that is not what we've seen happen. We have seen him convert and hold. And I think that's a just absolutely fine outcome. And it could be a very logical, logistic situation.
A question on the structured approach here with writing puts. I guess the real risk with that approach would be if the stock were to really plummet, and let's say there's either huge equity dilution, bankruptcy, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call it. What are your thoughts on that kind of outcome? My impression is that the Berkshire held debt is costly, but that Berkshire is the kind of party that would not push a company into bankruptcy mm-hmm. just to do that, but that they're going to do everything possible to help Seritage basically stay out of bankruptcy and wait for, their NOI and so forth to pick up.
Absolutely. You're bringing up a few great points there, John. So let me first address the bankruptcy issue and then the structured value question. So you are correct. I had to go through I actually had to have some help from an attorney to get through all of the covenants and understanding of all of the debt. It's amazing how customer friendly Berkshire Hathaway ultimately is, and they're not looking to be a sort of vulture. They actually want, when the crisis comes, they want to be able to lend to Bank of America at 10% and have that be a vote of confidence for the market, not the other way around. So they, of course, don't want to come and push them into bankruptcy. And there are things that are quite special with this it used to be 1.6 billion, now it's 1.44. Things like if their cash balance is, as I mentioned, about 160, although they may have used some of that to pay some of the debt. If their cash balance ever goes below 30, the debt, the interest just starts to accrue. They no longer have to make cash payments. There's all sorts of situations like that that are really beneficial. So I agree with you that I think Berkshire was a necessary lender and a great partner to have initially. As things are starting to develop and as the NOI becomes more stable and grows, I mentioned in one of those slides where we're looking at cash flows that there's about 36 coming on board and probably 45 more in the pipeline, and they already have 93 in revenue coming in. So, they're starting to get to a point where they're going to be able to be cash flow positive. And once they reach that level, I think they can confidently change their lender and just save $40 million a year, which is a huge amount for, like a sub 700 market cap firm. And so that's what they're looking to do. They have, this $800 million extension from Berkshire. We'll see if they use some or all of that. That's now going out to 2025. But I do think that they're working on all avenues of their financial statements. They're trying to grow their revenue. They're trying to reduce their costs. They're trying to lower their interest rates. They're working on everything at once. And I think the combined outcome is going to be quite large. Regarding the structured value, you're absolutely right. The fear is, of course, think of any investment. And of course, as I keep mentioning, there's all these controversial aspects to this firm, which is what I think is keeping it at these just very inexpensive prices. With any opportunity like this, when you're buying the stock, you're taking the risk that your thesis doesn't play out perfectly. And, you can always unwind a put that you've sold. So if the thesis changes, or we realize that some of these properties, Adventura or Dallas or some of these other properties in Santa Monica are not playing out and reaching the full valuation we expected, we could unwind something like this. And of course, it's an opportunity cost of capital, to be clear. We can really buy the shares today for a price of 12, or as we listed here, $12.70. Or alternatively, we can get paid to buy those in a year. And if something happens in the interim, we don't have to maintain the contract. We can just buy the contract back for the market price. These are market traded puts. And ultimately, you know, this the same bankruptcy or, you know, big drawdown in price impacts the equity holders as well as somebody who's sold a cash secured put. The cash secured put actually ends up with a margin of safety because they receive the premium that lowers their cost. I don't know if that made total sense. I kind of went in a circle, but
yeah, absolutely.
I'm happy to answer questions if people have them and want to reach out.
Yeah, maybe just one last question from me. I'm wondering what you think it'll take for some confidence to come back to this stock in the market. I mean, it seems like Mr. Market, so to speak, still doesn't really have confidence in the company, in the equity. What do you think will be kind of that tipping point?
I think there'll be a few things that happen over the next, say, let's call it 24 months. I think that they will make adjustments to their corporate and capital structure on a number of different levels, which will make them cash flow positive. So they'll lower their interest expense and they'll get these signed but not operating leases off the ground. I mean, this pandemic slowed things considerably. Prior to the pandemic, you know, the Buffett was buying at like $35 per share. And I don't think the property has the full value it did before the pandemic, but these are really real hard assets. And once they liquidate some of the billion-dollar portfolio and start repurposing and finishing the development and getting these tenants to move in and start paying, you know, I think we can see these moves, the prices move considerably. I mentioned how many times, I probably said it's a conservative estimate 100 times in this presentation. I think the value creation is just beginning. And a few years from now, we can see the shares at multiples of, you know, even the $26 I've stated. And I think it's going to be a little bit of getting to the end of the struggles with the COVID pandemic. It's going to be lowering some of the interest expense and proving to the market that they can obtain property level financing. It could be a few more big JV deals where they don't have to put up the capital, but they get cash coming in and then you know, their partner starts putting cash into the project. And it can be having people, not people, of course, but well, except for residential areas, but having tenants move into the commercial real estate space that they've made available. So I think I've sort of listed four, you know, potential opportunities for big re-ratings. And ultimately, those will lead to a positive cash flow. And the market tends to recognize these properties based on, or this type of business based on an NOI and a cap rate. And so this is a very strange REIT where they're not paying a dividend, cash flow is negative, and it looks really messy if somebody hasn't dug into it. So that needs to become a little more transparent. I think there's an opportunity for that within the next 24 months.
Terrific. Well, that's very helpful, Matt. I'll leave it there. I would just encourage fellow members to feel free to reach out with their own thoughts or questions. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and share this investment thesis with the MOI Global community.
Thank you, John. Pleasure's mine as always.
Best wishes. Goodbye for now.